Accession number 20064, Reel 1.
Ralph Dye, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Great Yarmouth.
Which year was this?
In 1923.
Can you tell me something about your family background, please?
My family, my father was in the police in Great Yarmouth, a police sergeant. And my mother was from a sort of fishing background, North Sea fishing people. My father was one of a great family of about 9, 10, or 11 brothers. And I don't know an awful lot about my mother's background.
Your father came from Yarmouth, did he?
That's right, yes.
Where did you go to school?
Yarmouth Grammar School.
What was the education like there in those days?
It was a small town, provincial grammar school of 400 boys. It took two entries, one with the scholarship boys from the 11-plus examination, which was how I got in, and then fee-paying students, from people who could afford it. And it gave basically a two-stream type education. One was on the classic side, which was history and languages, and the other side was moderns, German and science subjects and maths.
Which side did you go?
I took the history and languages.
What was the quality of education in those days?
I thought it was quite good. The headmaster was an Oxford man who came across very obviously Oxford, and there was all the masters wore gowns, and there was a traditional kind of approach, a grammar school tradition, and we were very strong, and there was very keen interest in sports, as I recall it, at the school.
How old were you when you left there?
I left at age 16. This is 1939. The war had broken out, and I was then in the beginning of my second year in the sixth form. And I left at Christmas 1939. And my parents, for a number of reasons, I thought, Yarmouth's frontline town was bombed occasionally already, and they had the background of the Great Depression, and they rather thought in terms of white-collar, pensionable kind of jobs, and put me into a bank, which I did for 2 years before I joined up at age 18.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
I'd been youth hostling. I'd been cycling in the Peak District, and I just came back and got to Yarmouth. I think either that day or the day before. I think it was that day I just arrived, just when everybody was standing around waiting for the 11 o'clock, as I remember it, the 11 o'clock, wasn't it? And listening to him make the announcement. And I just remember seeing the expression on the older generation faces. There was no jubilation, no joy, none of the First World War stuff like, jingoism and hurrah, we're off to war, that kind of. I think most of them remember the awfulness of the trenches, isn't it? Yeah.
Were you old enough to have any feelings about it yourself?
Yeah, I think we were all in quiet dread, I think. I didn't sort of think, well, this is going to be a great adventure. I think most of my chums in school were sort of spent the next, because I was only with them for 2 or 3 months after that until I left, but wondering what arms of the service we were going to go in, and some were going for the Air Force, and one man I knew said, well, I'm bloody well not going to charge across no man's land with a bayonet, and I just had no strong feeling either way. I knew I was going to be drafted, I expected it to be the army.
Did the war affect you in any way at first?
Did the war affect me? I served for 6 years. I was 21 when I did the D-Day landing, and I was wounded. And then I
Sorry, no, once war had been declared as a teenager in Yarmouth, did the war...
Oh, yeah, well, we joined things like what was it called, the messenger service of the civil defence, and we were supposed to ride on bicycles whenever there was an air raid and sort of deliver messages in case the communications broke down. And there was Black Hat, which was everywhere. But apart from that, life, for this was the beginning of the phony war, as it was called, life continued very much as was. And in those days, we used to go to the cinema a couple of times a week, and we continued to go to the cinema. And I think that was the main area that we got our news from, you know, the Pathé Gazette. There was no TV. And most people in Yarmouth were pretty isolated, apart from the radio, which just came in the 30s. I mean, I don't think many people had much idea of really who Hitler was and why, how he came to be there, except that we were aware that he wasn't a good thing to have around, you know.
Can you tell me what you remember about the bombing of Yarmouth area?
I remember the first bomb that dropped. I was with a chum and sitting in my parents' sitting room. We lived in a terrace house. And I was playing the piano, and suddenly there was this almighty bang, and it was the first bomb we'd ever heard, and it dropped in the corporation greenhouses about half a mile away. And I finished up under the piano stool in sort of, you know, response. I don't know where my friend was, and we looked quite startled by this. And the noise was, you know, very loud and very frightening. And then after that, I don't recall the odd hit-and-run raid, but in December I left Yarmouth and went down the Suffolk coast to Saxmundham, where I was working in the bank, and that was right on what must have become the invasion coast of 1940, 5 miles inland from Leiston and Aldborough.
What was your address in Yarmouth in those days?
Palgrave Road, 55 Palgrave Road, Great Yarmouth.
What do you remember about the national mood at the time when of Dunkirk and the fall of France?
I don't recall ever during the war a sense of people thinking we were going to lose. There was a tremendous sense of pulling together, the so-called Dunkirk spirit, which, you know, was later known as that. And that was very true. I think everybody's realizing they had to pitch in and bury whatever social differences they had and just join what they could, help however they could, and, you know, back up any appeals for help, for the financial help, Spitfire funds, which came in the 1940s. But I never, ever recall a sense that we were going to lose, even in the darkest days of the war. Yeah.
Did you listen to Churchill broadcasts?
I think I did, but there was some doubt about some of the famous ones, whether they actually ever were broadcast. I was aware of the "We'll Fight on the Beaches" speech, but where I heard it and when I heard it, I can't remember.
What about Lord Haw-Haw? Did you listen to him?
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
What did you think of him?
Well, he had people were amused by him because he had this strange accent, and also, but they were a bit intrigued because he always managed to sort of bring in a little bit of local stuff, like the clock on the church stopped at 1:10 yesterday. You know, we thought, oh, you know, they've got real insights here and real contacts, but. But he wasn't taken seriously. I mean, nobody believed these large claims he would make about large-scale victories at sea or, you know, any figures they gave. He was regarded purely and simply as propaganda, and that was it.
Had you personally expected that the Germans would invade?
Well, we had to take it very seriously. When I was in Saxmundham working for the bank, I joined the Home Guard, which was known as the LDV in those days, and then I became a member of a very strange organization which was sort of stay behind the lines commandos, and we were issued with special equipment, and we were supposed to be men who knew the countryside very well, and the Royal Engineers came and trained us in blowing up railway tracks with plastics and equipment. They dug a big hole in the woods and buried a Nissen hut in it and bunks. And we were supposed to stay behind and blow up the axle differentials on the German tanks when they came in. We had to take it seriously. We were 5 miles from the Suffolk coast, and when the units came back from Dunkirk, I cycled down there one night and spoke to one or two of the chaps down there, and they literally had 5 rounds of ammunition each, and that was it. And every night, this was 1940 in the spring and early summer after Dunkirk, every night pretty well German bombers were overhead and searchlights, and I used to man a pillbox in back of Saxmundham, and spent my nights up there and went to work during the day. Had a shotgun or something. And I forgot what I did have. It could have been it was an old Ross rifle they were issued with 5 rounds of ammunition. But then I used to also exercise with this very secret, we kept it very quiet, this other organization.
How did you come to be a member of the Stay Behind Commandos?
I don't know. I was just an athletic young chap. I hadn't yet got round to joining the army, and I was in there with a bunch of creaky old men who'd been spent their early years in no man's land, I think, you know. But they were local farm workers and knew the countryside. And I didn't really, not as well as they, but
do you remember any of the other individuals who were in it with you?
No, I don't. I can't remember any. That's too long ago.
You were the youngest, were you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, what instructions were you given?
Well, we had a sergeant, the Royal Engineers, who was sort of given this task of organizing these things, and he'd come round mostly at weekends and held special sessions of, you know, sabotage and training us in the use of plastic explosives, things like that. And then we'd have exercises crawling around the countryside trying to penetrate the perimeters of local units of the army, and more or less successfully. Some of the older chaps in the unit were not too athletic, and they kind of wheezed and grunted their way through the night countryside. But yeah, it was fascinating. Yeah.
You mean you broke into army bases?
Yeah, we had a couple of times we were told us all try and break through. I think they were tipped off not to fire anything, you know. But there were real active preparations for the landing. It was supposed to be one of the possible landing coasts there in Suffolk, down near Aldborough. Yeah.
What were you supposed to stick the plastic explosives onto?
On the differential of the rear axle of the tanks. And that would really, really do the trick, we were told. Then I think railway lines, I mean, if whatever presented itself, if they did come in. I don't think any of us would have lasted very long. We'd have been strung up on the nearest oak tree or something, as most partisans were. We were trained to be partisans, you know.
Did you feel apprehensive about it?
Oh, yeah, everybody felt apprehensive, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's right. I somehow couldn't take it quite seriously that this was really going to happen, but, you know, but we had every reason to take it seriously. Yeah.
How many men were in your Stay Behind Commando?
I couldn't give you. I'm guessing probably under 10. But they were all up and down this coast. I mean, I learned after in recent years of a commander here between Yarmouth and Beccles. In fact, the local man here runs a TV shop here. He used to be in it and has been given talks on this thing for some years. And he was quite intrigued to find that I'd been in one as well. Yeah.
And you had a base, you say? Like a Nissen hut?
Yes, buried in the woods. And there were a series of bunks in there, and we were supposed, if the invasion happened, we were supposed to go straight there and bury ourselves in the woods and saw Sally out at night with our various equipment. There was a big box full of explosives and detonators and time pencils and things.
Food supply?
I suppose there must have been. I don't recall that. I suppose there must have been plans to, you know, do that.
Whereabouts in the woods was this base?
I couldn't give you a map. It was about 4 miles west of Saxmundham in Suffolk.
What did the attitude of these farm workers seem to be towards being in it? Was it grim, or did they regard
no,
it as
No, I think they were genuinely glad that they could do something for the cause, you know. I mean, this was a... I don't think anybody seriously thought, could imagine an invading German army landing, but they were there and they were prepared to have a go if need be, you know.
How long did this go on for, being a member of the...
Well, of course, as far as I know, it went on after I left to join the army. I mean, this, I'm talking about 1940 when this happened, and I joined the army in the end of 1941. And for all I know, I never knew after that whether it continued or not, because the invasion threat lessened after by about then, and they may have just stood them down. I don't know.
And were the men who were in this commando also members of the Home Guard?
Oh, we were all members of the Home Guard, yeah. But we were sworn to secrecy.
So they were a selected group from the Home Guard?
That's right, yes, yes.
Which Home Guard unit did you belong to?
Well, it was the, I don't know, it was in, it must have been part of the Suffolk Regiment. It was a, it was the local Saxmundham Home Guard. I really can't remember.
And where did they meet?
In Saxmundham somewhere. And we used to exercise in the grounds of the big house, which is just south of Saxmundham, a mile down the road. And I don't have many recollections of this much.
Now, can you tell me about going into the army proper, please?
Yes, I was called up. I was called up in the signals, an RA signals regiment at Wakefield in Yorkshire. And I've forgotten the number of it now. But I do remember we were 82 squad. And at Nostell Priory, which is near Doncaster. And we were trained as artillery signallers. A three-month training. We were trained to drive, we were trained to operate radio sets, we were trained in the sort of routines of field artillery and signalling, and taught the Morse code, and we were graduated from this course about March 1942. I joined the army 4 days after Pearl Harbor, 11th of December 1941. All my fellow recruits were all mostly grammar school boys. And there was an 82 squad became a rather famous squad in the training regiment because we were all very bright and we were all, you know, good young soldiers. Yeah.
Any incidents that happened to you at that time?
No, none that I recall, no.
How did you take to the training?
Oh, I found it miserable the first few days. They didn't have shoes big enough for my feet, and I had tried it. It was snowy. It was a miserably cold winter, and I didn't like the basic training, but I enjoyed the signalling when we got onto signalling and driver training, and we moved around various estates in South Yorkshire and the Barnsley Wakefield area, and that was rather the signalling part was lovely. It was in a big country house. And we'd get out into small sections and communicate with each other and go through the radio drill and the techniques. And I recall it as a marvellous time of life. It was sort of uncluttered, you know, nothing else to worry about. Just very healthy, very fit, good company, and so much better than working in a bank, you know.
In what way was it better than working in a bank?
Well, the bank was just bloody dreadful. It was monotonous. It was Dickensian steel nibs and inkwells kind of stuff, you know. And it was dreary. It was the same thing every day. The routine was extreme, you know. You could tell yourself that 20 years from now on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 in the afternoon I'll be doing this job as I'm doing it now, because that's what the routine calls for, you know. And it was dull stuff. I mean, most of my friends, a lot of my friends did this because their parents were anxious to give them security. But very few of them ended up in banks after the war. They just went off somewhere more wholesome, more adventurous. The girls can do the job much better anyway.
Why did you not like basic training?
It was stamping feet on the parade ground kind of stuff, and I don't know. It was winter. It was rather dreary and miserable and cold and barrack conditions. And the country where we were stationed was rather dreary countryside, as a South Yorkshire coalfield. And in wartime, it was a very, very dreary place to be. It was just coal mining villages and not many facilities for recreation when you got out. And I was quite glad when it went on to something more interesting, like driving trucks and learning radio tech, and, you know.
How were you treated by the people in charge of the basic training?
Oh, they were all right. I mean, perfectly as you expected to be treated. You know, some of the usual barrack rat was giving you the drill and that kind of stuff. And they become part of the legend, you know.
Barrack rats?
We call them barrack rats, you know.
What's the meaning of that term?
Well, they'd spend a lot of their military careers around barracks, and they'd acquire the technique of drilling people on parade grounds. And, you know, and they'd find themselves a fairly comfortable niche to get through the war on, I suppose. Some of them are probably too old to get active service regiments or something.
So what happened to you next?
I was posted to the a field battery in the 53rd Welsh Division down in Kent. The headquarters were in Canterbury, and we were at Whitstable. And it was a 25-pounder battery. And I was a signaller in B Troop. It was 329 battery. I think it was... I couldn't tell you. 53rd Field Regiment. I'm not sure about that. And I spent 2 years with them, and we went to various places around that part of England, Rye and Sussex, Maidstone. For quite a while we were in Whitstable. And we did quite a lot of training exercises on places like Lark Hill on the Salisbury Plain, and up on the Downs behind Newhaven, quite frequently up on the South Downs. And I became an OP, an observation post signaller, and in fact became an OP ACK, which was the assistant to the OP officer. In other words, I could conduct shoots because I knew the technique. I was also a signaller, I was a driver. And we didn't realise quite the time, but that was a very dangerous job to be in, because you were always up front with the infantry. And you had to go on the highest point to sort of carry out observation. But we can direct gunfire. We were very highly trained. I mean, we were very good artillery people, because we were up at Seney Bridge up near Brecon one time, and they had a predicted shoot. I think it was about 5 miles range. And the target was a telephone pole, and they hit the pole, which was pretty good going. Yeah. So I enjoyed it to some point, but the trouble was that we were Englishmen posted to a Welsh unit, and the Welsh tended to sort of take care of their own, and we felt a little bit outsiders. This was a Territorial Army unit which had been in being since before the war. I think it had been stationed in Northern Ireland for a while, and everybody knew each other from civilian life, and you know. And we had a fair time sort of cracking the setup, to the point where I started volunteering for special service type stuff.
When did you start doing that?
I volunteered in the first thing I volunteered for was what I ended up doing on D-Day, which was forward observation for naval gunnery. And that was a direct sort of, you know, progression from field artillery 25-pounders to naval ships off an invasion coast. And we were trained in that at HMS Dundonald at Troon in Scotland. And I wasn't successful in that. I, of all things, caught a bout of flu when I was there and didn't finish the course, and was posted back to my unit. But I also applied at that time to be a glider pilot. I was determined to get killed, you know. So.
What happened to your application for glider pilot?
Well, I joined the glider pilot regiment in Salisbury, and I didn't pass out of the selection process in the regiment. I think I looked about 15 at the time, very baby-faced, and the rest of the guys looked pretty, you know, rugged, or older than I. And the other thing was that we were trained by Scots Guards Sergeant Majors, and they were trying to break our spirit to try and weed out the guys who just volunteered for this just to get out of the drudgery of everyday life. And one of the, we'd been hanging around for so long with nothing happening, you know, in the army, and it was very dreary at times, monotonous depending on where you were stationed. And so on this Fargo camp on near Lark Hill on the Salisbury Plain, we were put through this extreme Guards Brigade marching up and down parade ground stuff. And they weeded us out before they'd sent us off to flying school at Booker Airport in Oxfordshire, which is where the glider pilots train. Do you know Booker?
I've heard of it.
Yes. It's still a flying field now, somewhere near High Wycombe. Yeah. And I was moved across to the glider artillery, where I went back to being an OP AC for this unit, the glider artillery, which was known as an air landing light regiment, RA, which had been the Worcestershire Yeomanry. And they were just turned into airborne overnight kind of thing and put into red berets. And we were stationed at Bulford, and we had jeeps for each glider, a horse or glider. We had a jeep and a small ammunition trailer and a light 6-pound howitzer mountain gun. And they were loaded into horse or gliders, and that was the strange way of arriving at the battlefield. And I personally did not get a flight in a glider because they assumed that I'd been flying gliders, and I hadn't. But the rest of the guys did a couple of times. They took them off as training exercises. And round about, this was December 1943, about that time, again, they called for volunteers for observation for naval gunnery. And so I went back to Troon and did this course all over again. And of course, second time round, I came top of the group because I knew it all and, you know, was passed out and was posted then to a beach landing party in due course. So I went from Bulford, the 6th Airborne Division, I had a red beret, and to a HMS Vectis on the Isle of Wight, and joined my unit, a number 3 bombardment unit of the Royal Artillery. Now, number 3 bombardment units, this is a unit of the artillery which took part in nearly all the landings throughout the war. I mean, they had incredible sort of, you know, battle record, which was on a big board at HMS Dundonald, of all the landings like Madagascar and Sicily. And to anyone who hadn't yet been in action, this is very impressive. And I enjoyed the naval background. I mean, we were in naval barracks and we were, you know, sort of attached to the Navy and so on. And I reported to HMS Vectis and met up with the bombardment unit, number 3 bombardment unit. And they were stationed at Gurnard, which is just inland from Cowes on the Isle of Wight. This is at Cowes, by the way, HMS Vectis. And this would have been, I think, about March 44, not too long before D-Day. And I sort of joined my, we had an officer, a captain in the artillery. My captain's name was Tyrer, T-Y-R-E-R. And we had 3 naval telegraphists. And I was 21 years old. I just turned 21. And I was the old man of the party, except the officer was about 2 years older than I.